This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays. I'm Chuantik, sitting in for Juliet Jacobs. The term the Weinstein effect was coined following the fall of disgraced American producer Harvey Weinstein, who was outed as a sexual predator after numerous allegations of sexual abuse, sexual assault, and intimidations were leveled against him. He was in turn fired from the company he co-founded. This has emboldened women and men to share their untold or suppressed stories of sexual misconduct in the workplace and across countless industries. At the crux of the matter, though, many believe, is how those in positions of authority abuse and are allowed to abuse the power they wield. And joining us today to discuss the relationship between power and sexual harassment is Dr. Alicia Isharuddin, a senior lecturer in gender studies at University of Malaya. Dr. Alicia, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, can I begin by getting your thoughts on this news that Time magazine has chosen The Silent Breakers as Person of the Year, the people of the hashtag MeToo movement. What did you think of this recognition? Do you think it adds to the debate of bringing sexual harassment to the forefront?
Absolutely. I think naming these women and a few men as the Silent Breakers, as Person of the Year in Time magazine, is absolutely fantastic. What it has done is, as you said, it has raised public attention to sexual harassment and the seriousness of sexual harassment. And I think this is particularly important because there is a lot of misunderstanding and lack of awareness of what sexual harassment is. There is a misconception that sexual harassment is a minor crime. It's a form of small infraction in the workplace where some unwanted sexual attention, whether intended or not, occurs in the workplace, and then there's some feelings of discomfort, but it is never really understood as something as serious as sexual violence, rape, or sexual assault. So when you have Silent Breakers coming forward, they do bring to the forefront how traumatic sexual harassment can become and how incredibly detrimental sexual harassment can be on the professional lives of these women who, in all forms and instances, they are successful women, they are wealthy, affluent, they have connections, status and power. And yet, you know, for a long time, they had remained silent until now. So it does mean that sexual harassment is something that is, you know, that really needs to be unpacked further. And to make us fully understand what its repercussions are for both perpetrators and victims.
Why do you think there has been this disconnect on how severe sexual harassment must be taken? Because I think I'm guilty of that as well. When I hear the word sexual harassment, for example, it sounds like maybe bullying or teasing, and it doesn't occur to me that it involves rape or, you know, intimidation and something that you would feel, as you point out, a traumatic experience.
Yeah. Well, sexual harassment is incredibly serious, mainly because what it leaves behind on victims is not just discomfort, but a realization that they are treated as sex objects by either their peers at work or by their senior colleagues. And when they feel this lingering sense of discomfort, you know, they have to speak up about it. And speaking up does have repercussions on their own careers. You know, they'll be blacklisted as troublemakers. They could lose their jobs. They may not be promoted. People will distance themselves. They may not get jobs in the future should they move to another place. So these are the kinds of professional impacts on, especially on women's lives, when, you know, you find that women are paid less, so they cannot take that professional risk to move on to another job. And it springs from something as small as an unwanted physical contact. a sexual comment that is made on your body that you look really nice, and it could be as severe as offering sexual favors in return for a job promotion, for instance. So there is a spectrum of types of sexual harassment, but it does exist in, within a wider web of sexism in society that you could treat women in this way and get away with it.
So having said that, do you think then the term the Weinstein effect to describe this phenomenon is helpful or detrimental? Because it's been turned into a verb, isn't it? Like, you got Weinstein, or it's him just Weinsteining you, which is the language that you would hear maybe a workplace that is not so conducive describe the situation. Oh, he's just being, you know, that person, or that's his way of, you know, saying hi or getting friendly with you.
Oh, okay. Well, that's the first time I've actually heard Weinstein used as a verb. but I don't think it's very helpful because, like I said, I think there's still this lack of understanding of what sexual harassment constitutes. And there is a fine line between, there should be a very clear line, I'm sorry, between sexual harassment and flirting. Sexual harassment is by definition unwanted, non-consensual, whereas flirting is a playful back and forth and is absolutely consensual. And you are showing enthusiastic consent to participate in some kind of playful conversation with a person of the opposite or the same sex. So that should be by definition flirting. It should be distinguished very clearly from what sexual harassment is.
Have you faced any situation where this unwanted comment or flirt would be the wrong word, isn't it?
Yes.
Unwanted
sexual attention.
Comments, yeah, it's attention on yourself. And if you have, how did you react to it?
I think it's a reality of all women, different ages, and young girls to have experienced sexual harassment in some parts of their lives. Sometimes it's a daily occurrence for them. So whatever I'm speaking at the moment is not something unique to me, but it's actually a universal phenomenon. So for women, sexual harassment can occur in public spaces, on the street, when you're walking alone. As a female or with other female friends, you are subjected to catcalls, wolf whistling, other kind of comments on your physical attributes. So that constitutes sexual harassment in a public space. But for me, sexual harassment that I've also, other forms of sexual harassment that I experienced have been sexual comments by men that I know, and in which they would make comments about the sexual relationships they have had with other women they have known and would want my reaction from their experiences as a way of maybe spicing up the conversation a bit, even though that conversation, the nature of that conversation was clearly unwanted. So my reaction would have been clear disturbance, and it was traumatic, requiring a lot of support from friends and family. Speaking up about it absolutely helps. And I know for a lot of women, even harassment does require some amount of counselling and therapy afterwards too.
Mm-hmm. When you speak up, do you expect support, or do you expect the person who made the comment to just stop? Or oftentimes, is it a futile expression?
To make the person stop?
Yeah.
It's hard to say because the person who has committed sexual harassment might not just do it to you, but they might commit that on other people you don't know or you may know. And whatever you might do, it might make it quite difficult to stop this behaviour. Especially when we currently live in this culture where women are disbelieved, and whatever kind of accusations that you make towards a person on a person's sexual misconduct, there are efforts by the perpetrator and by their supporters to discredit the women who make the accusations. And in addition to efforts to discredit, the woman's life itself falls under microscopic scrutiny, you know, all sorts of prurient information is dug out of these women's lives, you know, as a way of making her not a pure victim, but also perhaps complicit in this incident of sexual harassment. So it's similar to rape victims, that they have brought it onto themselves. So they are not pure victims. It was perhaps because of the way she dressed, how she spoke to the perpetrator. And so these are ways of discrediting, and it's no surprise that as a result, women do not want to come forward. Instead, they keep silent about it because they know that this can happen to them. Especially so when we live in a culture where sexual shaming or slut shaming is so prevalent.
Why is that technique so effective, do you think?
Mainly because women are hardly ever given the opportunity to speak up. And when they do, they are shut down. And so if they would bring, they would try their best not to bring negative attention to themselves, mainly because we live in a culture here in Malaysia where speaking up on an issue that you really believe in would make you a target of abuse, would make you a target of threats. You could lose your job. And if you were to bring attention to yourself because you had been a victim of a misconduct or a crime that has a sexual nature, so even more so that you would expect even more virulent forms of threats coming at you. And also there are numerous efforts that would be mobilized to protect, of course, the reputation of the perpetrator. By friends, by their supporters, because perpetrators' reputations are far more important than the trauma that, you know, victims experience.
Yeah, because if it happens to a woman, it's slut-shaming, isn't it? Whereas for a male, it's a conquest to be bragged about.
Yes, absolutely.
The disbelieving, does it come from women as well?
Women
who disbelieve women? And why is that?
This is an interesting phenomenon. I find that a lot of women, however strong they are, they do not like to see themselves as victims. So if they were to hear another woman coming forward to say that they have been victimized, there's a kind of exposure of, yet again, here's another woman who is becoming a victim of something when actually she could rise above it. So it makes other women uncomfortable. And it's a psychological effect, I find, that women don't want to believe that they themselves could have been a victim of sexual harassment. So in my case, just to go back to an earlier question that you asked, when I became a victim of sexual harassment, then again, there are different types of sexual harassment. One is seemingly much more obvious than others, like the public harassment is very obvious. But when it occurs from someone that you know and you trust, it takes a bit of time to register. And when you feel hurt, traumatized, and psychologically uncomfortable, you don't really have a language for it until you tell that to someone. And that's when you realize, oh my goodness, I'm a victim. And that realization can also be uncomfortable for the victims too. So, and other women can't believe that you know, an empowered woman who is very strong, who can sort of fight her way out of a difficult situation. How can you be a victim? We know what a victim really is. You know, she's someone who is helpless, who can't, you know, who is easily victimized by others. So there's that additional thing as well of what really is a victim. There is a stereotype, perhaps.
I'm speaking today to Dr. Alicia Isharuddin, Senior Lecturer in Gender Studies at University of Malaya. We're talking about the Weinstein effect. After this short break, I'll ask her about how this Me Too movement has been received in Malaysia. You're listening to BFM 89.9. You're listening to Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture. I'm Chua Antik, sitting in this week for Juliet Jacobs. My guest today is Dr. Alicia Isharuddin, Senior Lecturer in Gender Studies at University of Malaya, and we're talking about the Weinstein effect. Alicia, you are a teacher. You teach at a university. I guess you come across a lot of young people. And as far as you can tell, how has this movement been received in Malaysia? Because of your specialties and what you teach, has people come up to you and ask you a lot about your thoughts on this?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So you're quite right. I teach gender studies at the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences in University of Malaya. And my students themselves want to do class presentations on sexual harassment. And the Harvey Weinstein revelations and allegations are unavoidable. You know, they want to talk about it because it's in the news every day. So they are aware of it. And then, of course, you do have pockets of students who still confuse sexual harassment with sexual violence, sexual assault. And then it speaks to this, misunderstanding, I think, of different types of crime. There is some, it's all part of a continuum, I feel. And I feel, however, even though I allow a space for students to talk about this, I am still unsure whether or not the reception of the Harvey Weinstein allegations are sort of have opened up spaces of discussion and outings and accusations on a wider scale here in Malaysia. That remains to be seen.
But are you not encouraged by maybe some posts of women who are reflecting maybe on their past and suddenly realize that was an instance of harassment that I shouldn't have brushed off?
Yes.
Yeah. So, do you see enough of that in the Malaysian context?
Oh, no, definitely not enough. I find that the reception on a much more general scale, quite muted, quite quiet. When we look at the men who are outed, the men who lose their jobs, the men who resign, they step down from political positions, from sort of high-profile media companies, we in Malaysia, we're looking at these things happening as if it's happening from far away. It's a nice view to look at. It's like a justice, you know, prevailing, but happening far away, but not quite happening here. And if I could explain why the Harvey Weinstein effect is not quite taking place in Malaysia, I could point back to the cultural shaming that we have. But also, you know, going back to the issue of power in this society, our hugely patriarchal society in which men of, you know, high status have a lot of things that could protect them from allegations, from accusations of misconduct and crimes. And men in this society, small crimes, big crimes, they can get away and walk out in public with impunity, and nothing seems to touch them. So if we were to talk about sexual harassment to try to bring a man down, you know, it's not going to actually bring him down very much in a society where people say bigger crimes are being committed and nothing is happening to them. In fact, you know, we see alleged criminals, their reputations being rehabilitated, and then they have, you know, they have no longer the taint of crime on their reputation. So, so people are perhaps suspicious of the impact of Harvey Weinstein and his allegations in the Malaysian context.
What do you think needs to happen before we can get to where, to getting even to a semblance of where the US is at the moment? And if you could tell, what was the tipping point in their example? You know, which was the first person who, you know, made an impact in successfully getting their story believed and the perpetrator saw a repercussion?
Yes, good question. But I think I have to answer those two things a bit separately. What we need to do here as opposed to what happened there to trigger that sort of domino effect of the Harvey Weinstein case. So what we need to do here is, of course, regardless of the pessimistic situation where women are shamed for speaking up, I still urge women and girls out there to come forward and speak, because the tipping point is where you have lots of women coming forward. And when you have multiple numbers of women, that serves as a kind of protection. But you see, that itself is a problematic idea, because is there like a number that you need to reach when people start to believe? Does it mean that when only one woman comes forward, that woman cannot be believed? So you need like huge numbers of women coming forward accusing one man of sexual misconduct. Then, you know, this man cannot be disbelieved. But at the same time, in the US situation, even that is, contentious, because we have the current US president of the United States, Donald Trump, is accused by up to 12, 13 women. You can correct me on that. And the revelations that he had boasted of sexually assaulting women and thinking that he would get away with it still got him to become the president of the United States. So, you know, we are looking at a quite complex landscape here. And the tipping point for Harvey Weinstein is a group of women who feel that perhaps the U.S. Cultural landscape has sort of pushed the patience of people within, you could call, the progressive media industry. You know, we cannot take this sitting down anymore. Because we have to remember, before the first few women came forward in October this year, women have already started talking about his sexually inappropriate behavior. Women like Rose McGowan, who spoke up implicitly. She didn't name him, but now she feels brave enough because there are other women alongside her. So there were other women who more or less came forward, but they were not listened to in the past, but now they do.
Yeah, like you said, everyone in the industry knows and joke about
yes,
it.
Yes, it's an open secret. Mm-hmm. But now it's no longer an open secret. It's absolutely out in the open. So just to jump back to the Malaysian context, we need to follow and emulate some of the steps that women have taken over there, and then to sort of speak up, but at the same time, it's very important to name. And that's what's happened also in France. They have their own separate movement called Balance ton porc, expose your pig, which specifically gets women to name the men who have committed sexual crimes against them. But that has been derailed now by the Islamophobia surrounding the case of Tariq Ramadan, who was also himself accused of sexual assault against several women.
How much do you think the movement of the Me Too social movement has been led by predominantly white women in the West? And are we hearing enough of voices from other parts of the world? And could it be that despite their well-intentioned, that they're believed more because of who they are, how popular they are in the industry? It takes all of that in order for something like this to happen. So if you don't have, I don't know, powerful friends in high places, the chances of getting believed, if you want to be the first person to... Because I remember reading about the reporters who did the first New York Times story on breaking the...
Ronan Farrow
was for The New Yorker, and then Jody Cantor and a colleague at The New York Times broke the New York Times story, that even before they approach all the victims or women with stories to tell about Harvey Weinstein, they have been approached multiple times in the past by reporters, and stories about Weinstein has been shut down in the past. Mm-hmm. And even while doing the story with the backing of an institution like the New York Times and the New Yorker, journalists still get harassed. Can we move past that, or do you see it as a predominantly movement led by white women?
Yes, Up to now, I think there is a lot of criticism that most of the attention surrounding the Me Too hashtag movement have been mostly women, white women, actresses, you know, young, relatively young, beautiful women who have come forward. And the number of women of color who have spoken up have been fewer or reported by fewer reporters, I find. I think there's no real... One of the problems here is that for a long time, women of color have been disproportionately affected by multiple forms of oppression, sexism and racism. And there is this understanding within feminist discourse that women of color are disbelieved, the crimes that are committed against them are taken less seriously. But when you have white women, and this is called the white woman syndrome, where whenever a white woman who is, especially if she's blonde, she's young, and she becomes a victim of crime, whether it is sexual violence or murder, there is lots of attention on this woman. And also we will find that that the punishment meted out against the perpetrator is much more severe against perpetrators who have committed crimes against white women than women of color.
It comes back to power and incentive, isn't it? Because it's easy to dismiss a secretary or a personal assistant because they are quote-unquote climbing the corporate ladder. Whereas if an Ashley Judd or a Gwyneth Paltrow comes up, like, they have nothing to lose. They have nothing to gain, rather, because people know who they are. Mm-hmm. They are wealthy enough to not need to require assistance from Weinstein anymore. So it's mostly a power imbalance, isn't it?
It is. And one of the things that it has exposed to all of us is that actually perhaps these women, being women and actresses, they are perhaps not as powerful as we thought they were. Otherwise, you know, they would have come forward immediately after something had happened to them. Instead, they kept this quiet, they were silenced, and because their careers are on the line. Instead, there are these shadowy figures like Harvey Weinstein who sort of have access to their success. And ultimately, it is about power. It is about sort of this male dominance of an industry in which male excesses, heterosexual male excesses, is a problem that permeates not just the media industry, of course. You can see this in other male-dominated institutions and professions and politics, even in media, journalism, where women are beholden to these men, no matter how powerful they are. And it just means that, you know, we have to change this culture. It sort of makes much more urgent to have more women in these industries so that, you know, you have a leadership culture where it's not about this competitive macho culture where your success as a man is tied to how many women you have slept with. And this is still sort of prevalent in so many male-dominated culture. And also the other problem with impunity as well, where men can just get away with small things, big things, leaving a trail of female victims in his wake.
So I guess we can't talk about what we're talking about without addressing the reaction from men about, you know, when does courtship or the pursuit of a romantic partner disintegrate into harassment, because this is we're losing the romance argument, isn't it? What would be your thoughts to that?
Oh, I think that is, I think that's absolutely untrue. And it's very worrying that men feel afraid now that they cannot approach women if they were interested in, someone out there for fear of being accused of sexual harassment. But we have to make it clear again, if it's unwanted, stop. If you are not sure if you want to hug someone or put your arm around someone, maybe, ask. be certain whether you know this person well enough to cross that boundary. And also, in a professional setting, you know, when we talk about sexual harassment in the workplace, there are clear professional boundaries that, you know, you shouldn't be too touchy-feely, I suppose, with your female or colleagues of the same sex. But again, I think it boils down to the issue of consent, enthusiastic consent especially. And it comes very important here is men to respect women's voices. That is also severely lacking in our society and elsewhere, where when women speak, women are not taken seriously. When women say no, it's taken as a yes. And it applies both in a situation where we're talking about sexual assault and male attempts at courting or wooing a woman. Same rule applies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because flirting is a, it's a funny game, isn't it?
Cause it's consensual. It's a, it has two people consenting and playfully back and forth.
There is this narrative that's out there that a guy who's maybe pursuing, a happily married couple who would tell a story of how the guy has pursued the girl or the wife for a long time before the wife agreed to. Maybe they met in high school, but throughout their working years,
yes,
he was relentless or persistent and never ceasing in his expressions of love and romance. And should that be seen as a negative behavior, stalkish even by all standards?
It depends on how aggressive the pursuit was, you know, whether it was on the border of stalking, which would already enter crime, an area of a crime. Now, that kind of narrative, you know, that's a hypothetical, perhaps it occurs in real life also. It comes from a very traditional idea of the male, you know, the man as the pursuer, and a woman sits passively waiting to be caught, waiting to be pursued by somebody. And we don't live in that kind of society anymore. We don't live in a society where women are just waiting to be sort of taken by, all women want to be sort of pursued by other people. And I think also we should sort of don't confuse these things, you know. And I think women would just draw the line where stalking does not lead to an acceptance of a marriage proposal. Because it would lead you to, you know, being reported to the police. But please, I don't think it's really helpful to sort of create these confusions. I think you should be quite clear.
How much is it has to do with men not knowing how to accept no for an answer? Right? We create terms like friend zones to explain why a woman is not interested in you.
Yes.
You create, I guess, backstories around why she would say no, because no one has ever said no before.
Yes. I really dislike the term friend zone, to be honest, because behind the word friend zone is actually a culture that we have accepted of male entitlement to sexuality, to sex. And, you know, a man has to have access to a woman sexually until the moment she says, no, I'm not interested in you in that way. And then that is seen as a kind of injustice, which is why the word friend zone has that tragic connotation. But you don't hear this term friend zone so much being applied to a woman who is friend zoned by a guy or friend zoned by another woman. But a it becomes so much more tragic if a man is friend-zoned by a woman. And then here we see a woman who is asserting her agency to say no, and that should be a good thing. But instead, it's like, it's really sad because it's too bad this man cannot have sexual access to this woman anymore.
What is the lesson here? What would be your final message? How do we make sure this movement don't just die a natural, tragic death?
I can start by saying we have to promote a culture of believing women, whether it's a single woman, because we know that there are serious social repercussions that happen to a single woman who stands up, you know, puts her head up the parapet and be shot down. So this starts with one woman speaking up, and then you will have a wave of other women who, you know, become braver to speak up as well. We need to have a culture in which the perpetrators themselves, you know, face the repercussions themselves of their own crimes. And I think this is a worry that a lot of men feel afraid that they have become, you know, perpetrators of violence, and they didn't realize that they were criminals in some respects. And does this mean that every other man is going to be a criminal of sexual harassment or some sexual misconduct? And there is that worry now that what's going to happen? Is this man going to be mistaken for a rapist? And again, it comes from a culture where we're afraid of men's reputation being tarnished. We're much more afraid of men losing their jobs, their families suffering. But we don't go back to, imagine the number of years women have kept silent over something that has happened to them. Can you just imagining the level of struggle and the pain and trauma that these women experience? All of this is being deflected back to, oh no, men are just going to be criminals now unless, you know, their innocence are being proven by, you know, by other people. I think we, I don't really care if men lose their jobs, to be honest, because we are reaching a very important cultural moment in history, in which a crime, as you could say, minor as sexual harassment, is taken very seriously. This is a major turning point, and this is not a time for heterosexual men to worry whether, you know, they have possibly committed a sexual misconduct at any point in their lives. It's not about them.
What does believing mean when you say believe a woman?
It means you have to take their word for it. It means understanding that it's hard to talk about the things that have happened to them, the experience of sexual assault, the experience of being sexually harassed by somebody, understanding, having some kind of empathy that they too, the person who's listening, will be a victim one day, and that they too will be comforted by the idea that if should that happen to them, of whatever seriousness, they will be believed also.
Alicia, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Thank you.
That was Alicia Isharuddin, Senior Lecturer in Gender Studies at University of Malaya. You've been listening to Feminist Fridays, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.